Because I did nothing wrong.
Oh, I see.
Brody looks away from me toward the jury, then turns his stare back to me.
You just coincidentally decided that it was a good time to move on, at the same time that you were under investigation.
As a matter of fact, yes, I say. And I would add, there's no need to add, he says, patting the air.
You answered my...
I would add that the district attorney's office was free to charge me whether I worked for the NYPD or not, but they didn't. There is so much more I could say. Everything that happened that led up to that bogus charge. But I don't have the energy to fight.
Brody smirks. He's gotten all he can here. Detective, you weren't present for this alleged conversation between Chief James and Noah Walker.
Correct. I was down the hall from the jail cell.
You have no first-hand knowledge of what was said between them?
First-hand? No.
You took the chief's word for it?
Yes.
And this jury,
says Brody, gesturing toward the jury box.
They have to take not only the chief's word for it, but yours as well.
I'm not sure I take your point, counselor.
This jury has to believe that you're telling the truth about what the chief said, and that the chief told the truth about what my client said.
I nod. I suppose that's right.
They have to believe you, who resigned while under investigation for being a dirty cop. Objection! Says Sebastian Akers, jumping to his feet. Sustained.
Brody doesn't break stride.
And they have to believe the chief, whom they don't get to hear from at all.
I pause a beat, anger surging to the surface.
That's right. They don't get to hear from the chief, Mr. Brody, because your client killed him before he could testify.
I brace myself for an objection, for Brody to go crazy, for the judge to excuse the jury and give me a thorough dressing down. But to my surprise, Brody doesn't object.
My client hasn't been arrested for that murder, has he?
Not yet.
As far as you know, there is no physical evidence implicating my client.
Not yet.
Very good, detective.
I have no idea why he's letting my statement slide. Presumably he's calculated that every juror, every human being in the Hamptons has heard about the chief's murder, and most believe that Noah killed him. He must figure it's easier to acknowledge it, so he can make his points about the lack of any arrest or evidence thus far. Or does he have some other reason?
Can you tell the jury what happened to you the day after this alleged confession?
The following day?
Yes, detective,
he says, approaching me, a spark in his eyes.
Isn't it true that the following day you were suspended for 1 month from active duty?
The spectators react sufficiently for the judge to call for silence. Yes, I guess that was the following day, now that you mention it.
Why were you suspended?
Because I doubted the guilt of Noah Walker. Because I thought the murder of the prostitute might be connected to the Ocean Drive murders. But I can't say that. It would be a gift-wrapped present to the defense. And it's not what Lang said in the report he wrote up. That would be the last thing he'd write down. Insubordination, I say. I let our personal relationship intrude on our professional relationship. I was disrespectful and I was wrong.
You were disrespectful to him.
I was, I answer, feeling a lump in my throat, recalling the moment.
You and your uncle, you were upset with each other?
I feel the first hints of emotion creeping in.
I'm not going to break down in front of this jury.
He was certainly upset with me, I say, and he was right to be.
You feel, I can see that you feel guilty about that.
I don't answer. I don't need to.
Looking back, it bothers you, doesn't it? That just before his death, you were disrespectful to your uncle.
I know what my answer should be. It should be yes, but that doesn't mean I would lie for him. But that is precisely what I'm doing here today. It bothers me, I answer.
You wish you could make it up to him.
Again, I don't answer. He doesn't wait very long.
You think my client killed your uncle, correct?
I nod. Yes.
But you'd agree with me that with the full resources of the STPD on the case for almost a week, there has been no proof thus far to back up your suspicion.
Not yet.
So this case here, he says, pointing to the floor. This case might be your only chance to get Noah Walker.
Objection, says Akers, but the judge overrules him.
And with the chief unable to testify about the supposed confession from my client, and with the judge on the verge of dismissing the charges against my client, you now suddenly come forth to claim that the chief told you about this confession immediately.
He snaps his finger.
Immediately after it happened.
I don't reply. My eyes move along the floor, then upward to the defense attorney.
What a convenient and unexpected coincidence,
Brody says, waving his hands. I look at Noah Walker, his chin resting on his fists. He watches me intently, his eyebrows pitched, as if he pities me.
No further questions, says Brody.
Chapter 26. Noah Walker places his head gently against the bars of his holding cell, barely touching Paige Sulzman's head on the other side. His hands come through the bars and interlock with hers. I don't like you coming here, he says. I don't like you seeing me like this.
I know, baby. Good thing I'm stubborn.
It's not a good idea. How would John?
John's in Europe, Copenhagen this week, I think. I told you, he'll be gone for another 2 weeks.
Despite his protests, Noah looks forward to the 15-minute visits Paige is allowed every night in lockup. Riverhead is a dank, dark, miserable cesspool, purgatory for the accused in Suffolk County, short on hope and long on desperation and bitterness. Paige, with her freshly cut hair and generous smile, her sympathetic eyes and gentle demeanor, is like a rose sprouting in a swamp of manure.
You could use a shave and a haircut, she says, trying to keep it light.
He acknowledges the attempt at humor, but it's hard to find anything funny right now. The trial is at its apex. Difficult decisions need to be made.
Your lawyer did a good job today.
The hope in Paige's expression, the tears shimmering in her eyes, reveal her lack of objectivity, but Noah doesn't totally disagree.
Yeah, he did. But still, babe, the jury heard a cop say I confessed to the murders. What's the jury supposed to think when they hear I confessed?
That she made it up, Paige replies. That she's trying to make it up to her uncle out of guilt. I thought that came through very clearly.
Yeah, I know.
He doesn't sound like he's convinced, because he's not. Yes, his lawyer did a good job cross-examining Detective Murphy, but the jurors seem to like her regardless, and their opinions are the only ones that matter.
She just lied, Paige says, spitting out the words. She just lied.
Noah pursed his lips.
She thinks I'm guilty. I could see it that night, when she broke into my house. She thinks I killed her uncle, and she thinks I killed Zach and Melanie, too. She thinks she's doing the right thing.
Paige draws back.
You're defending her? You must be joking.
Noah almost laughs at the paradox, the fact that he's sticking up for the cop who lied on the witness stand to put him away.
I understand why she did it.
He wants to be upset with Murphy. She's surely no friend of his. But there's something in the way she handles herself, like she's trying to prove something to somebody but isn't sure what she's proving or to whom. He feels like he understands her, and regardless of what she did to him today, he can't shake the feeling that they understand each other, that she doesn't really believe deep in her heart that he's guilty.
Oh, why is this happening?
Paige says softly. There's no answer to that question. Noah feels like he's caught in a tornado, unmoored from any reality, whisked away with brutal force and carried through the air against his will. He has lost all control, forces beyond his reach. The sensationalist media, ambitious prosecutors, crooked cops, have aligned to deem him guilty and deny him any chance of fighting back. He must focus on this one fact. It doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks. It only matters what 12 jurors believe. He's seen the looks on their faces, their disgusted expressions, their averted eyes. He knows he has an uphill battle. He can only hope that their minds are still open, however slightly, to what he has to say. He has to testify. His lawyer doesn't want him to, but he has no choice. He has to find some way to convince those jurors that he's not the killer they think he is. If he fails, his life is over. Chapter 27. Joshua Brody lets out a sigh. Almost 3 hours have passed, Noah testifying in response to Brody's questions, and now it's coming to an end. A pregnant pause by the lawyer to emphasize these final questions, questions already asked and answered, but important enough to be repeated.
"Let me ask you one last time, Noah," says Joshua Brody. "Did you kill Melanie Phillips?"
Noah leans forward into the microphone on the witness stand.
"No, I did not."
"Did you kill Zach Stern?"
"No, I did not."
Joshua Brody casts a glance at the jury. "No further questions." Noah takes some deep breaths, halfway done, the easy half, and it wasn't that easy. It has to feel natural, not rehearsed, his lawyer kept telling him as they prepared for today. And Noah feels like, all in all, it was convincing. From time to time during Joshua Brody's questioning, he glanced over at the jury. Did he see reasonable doubt on their faces? He doesn't know. This isn't what he does for a living. And he's in the moment, tense and focused. He wouldn't trust his instincts anyway. But he can't suppress the surge of hope he feels. He has a chance.
"Cross-examination?" Judge Barnett asks.
The prosecutor, Sebastian Akers, drops a notepad on the lectern between the prosecution and defense tables. This is the kind of moment a guy like Akers lives for. The packed courtroom, the big trial, the cross-examination that will make or break this case.
"Keep your composure," his defense attorney told Noah.
Akers wants to paint you as someone who committed murder in a blind rage. He wants you to show the jury that rage. He's going to try to bring it out, get you upset.
"Mr. Walker," Akers begins, "you have no alibi for the night of the murder, correct?"
Noah clears his throat.
"As I told Mr. Brody, I stayed in that night."
Akers makes a face.
"What I meant was, nobody can corroborate your alibi, correct?"
"Correct."
"The jury has to take your word, and only your word for it."
"Yeah, I guess so."
"And you admit you were once given a key to the front door of 7 Ocean Drive, correct?"
"Yes, I've done work on that mansion for years. At some point, it made sense for the contractor who used me to just give me my own key."
"And that key has now magically disappeared."
"I don't know about magically, but I don't know where it is."
There was no evidence of forced entry at the mansion on the night of the murders. The fact that Noah had his own key isn't a good fact for him.
"You deny that you confessed to this crime to Chief James. You deny that, right?"
"Yes."
"So when he said you did, he wasn't telling the truth?"
"He wasn't."
"And when Detective Murphy testified to what the chief told her about your confession, she wasn't telling the truth either?"
"I don't know if she was or not. Maybe the chief said that to her. Maybe he didn't."
"If he did, then he was lying to her too."
"Right."
"Or maybe Detective Murphy just made the whole thing up. Right, Mr. Walker?"
Noah feels perspiration on his forehead, his neck.
"Could be."
"So maybe she was also lying, right, Mr. Walker?"
"Maybe."
"Sure,"
Akers says with no shortage of sarcasm, flipping a hand.
"And Dio Cornwall, who shared a cell with you in lockup, who testified that you confessed to killing Melanie, that you said you cut her up good, and that she couldn't be no movie star now, Mr. Cornwall was also lying, right, Mr. Walker?"
"He was lying. I never said anything like that to him. I never talked to him about my case at all."
"I see."
Akers looks at the jury.
"Any idea how Mr. Cornwall would have known the name Melanie, or that she'd wanted to be a movie star if you didn't tell him anything about your case at all?"
I don't know. Maybe he read it in the newspaper."
"The newspaper?"
"Mr. Walker,
Dio Cornwall was in lockup with you. Do you recall ever being given a copy of any newspapers while you were in lockup?
Noah pauses. He casts his eyes downward.
If you like, we can bring in the sheriff's deputies who controlled lockup while you were...
No, we never got newspapers, Noah concedes. I don't know how Dio got that information. Maybe Chief James told him.
Chief James? So now you're saying not only that Chief James lied about your confession, but that he helped Dio Cornwall make up a story too?
I don't know.
And Chief James isn't here to testify, is he, Mr. Walker? So we'll never be able to ask him, will we?
Noah fixes a glare on the prosecutor. He feels his blood go cold.
During your direct testimony, you admitted that you confronted Melanie at her job at Tasty's Diner, asking her to take you back. You admit that, correct?
Noah shakes his head, focuses on the change of subject.
Yes, I admit that we argued and I grabbed her arm, but Remy has the date wrong. He said it happened 2 days before Melanie was killed, June 2nd. But that's wrong. Melanie broke up with me in April, about 7 weeks before she died. That's when I talked to her at Tasty's.
He met Paige a week after Melanie dumped him, in April. He'd moved on from Melanie, but he's never told anyone that. He's never publicly acknowledged his affair with Paige, and he won't now. No matter how many times Paige has told him to do so, he won't bring Paige into this.
Akers nods along, his eyes alight. Pretty big difference between April, 7 weeks before the murder, and 2 days before the murder.
Yes, it is.
So Remy's lying too.
I don't know if he's lying,
but he's not telling the truth.
That's right, he's not.
So, to summarize, Akers says, strolling along the edge of the jury box, Chief James, Detective Jenna Murphy, Dio Cornwall, and Remy Handelman, none of them are telling the truth, but you, Mr. Walker, on trial for your life, whom Melanie broke up with so she could start dating Zach Stern, you are telling the truth.
Noah feels his pulse ratchet up. The way Akers is stacking up all the evidence, nobody's going to believe Noah. It hits him hard for the first time. They won't believe me. They're going to convict me.
I'm telling the truth, he pleads. I swear I am. I would never hurt somebody else.
You'd never hurt anybody?
Akers asks with mock innocence.
Well, Mr. Walker, isn't it true that in 1995, you brought a rifle to Bridgehampton School and opened fire on a number of your classmates?
Chapter 28. The courtroom erupts at Sebastian Akers' question. Noah's defense lawyer, Joshua Brody, is on his feet, arguing. Judge Barnett stands down from the bench and walks to the far end of the courtroom, away from the jury, for a sidebar with the lawyers. The spectators are all abuzz. I wasn't in Bridgehampton back in 1995, but I have a memory of Uncle Lang mentioning that someone had brought a BB gun to school and shot a bunch of the kids on their way into school. He never mentioned a name. No reason he would have. This was before Columbine, before zero-tolerance policies cropped up around the country and kids were expelled from school for even bringing toy replicas in their backpacks. If this was in 1995, Noah would have been young. 11, 12, 13, something like that. It would have been a juvie beef. And if it was in juvenile court, it would have been confidential. I wonder if the town even knew who it was who did it. There would be rumors, sure, but I wonder if there was ever an official announcement. Judging from the reaction of the spectators, many of whom are presumably lifelong Bridgehampton residents, it seems like they're hearing this news for the first time. The lawyers and court reporter and judge resume their positions, and the room goes quiet again. Noah's lawyer, Joshua Brody, objects. This is a juvenile offense, he says. Your Honor, Sebastian Akers replies. He just testified he'd never hurt anybody. He opened the door. I'm entitled to impeach him. Overruled, says the judge. Proceed, Mr. Akers. And the prosecutor does just that, with a vengeance, a gleam in his eye. You were arrested on Halloween 1995 for shooting a number of school children on the south playground of Bridgehampton School. Correct, Mr. Walker?
I was arrested, yes. It was a BB gun. 15 school kids were shot that day, weren't they? I believe that's right. One child was hit in the eye, wasn't he? Noah nods but doesn't speak. That boy was 9, says Akers. He had to have 2 surgeries to repair the damage. Isn't that true? Noah's eyes are fixed on the floor now. That happened, yes. Yes, that happened. That happened because you shot him with a BB gun, correct? Noah doesn't speak, still staring at the floor. Is that a yes, Mr. Walker? I didn't shoot him, Noah says, almost in a whisper, though the microphone gives it sufficient volume. No? You didn't shoot that boy? You were wrongfully accused then, too, is that it? I didn't shoot him. I see. So when school officials said you did, they weren't telling the truth either, were they? Noah's shoulders close in on him, like he's trying to shelter himself from a storm. I don't want to talk about that anymore, he says. Oh, Akers lets out a chuckle. Well, what do you want to talk about? The Yankees' chances in the postseason? That gets a roar from the spectators. I thought it was clever, too, but I'm watching Noah. His face is turning red. He's practically curled up into a ball. Akers, if he's half the trial lawyer he thinks he is, senses it too. By the time the laughter has subsided and the judge has gaveled the room to order, Akers has slowly approached Walker, a tiger stalking prey. You shot 15 people that day, Mr. Walker. But you claim the school officials lied. I said I don't. Just like you claim a decorated police chief, Langdon James lied. Noah shakes his head. Just like Detective Murphy lied. It's clear now Noah's not going to answer, and that seems to be fine with Akers. He's watching. We're all watching. A defendant smoldering on the witness stand, and Akers is hoping he'll erupt. Just like D.O. Cornwall lied. Just like Remy Handelman lied. Noah turns his head away as if he's done with this examination. All of them lied, says Akers. It's a grand conspiracy, isn't it, Mr. Walker? The whole world against you. Noah says something, but he's turned away from the mic and it's inaudible. Mr. Walker. Yes, Noah hisses, spinning around, nearly knocking over the microphone. Akers jumps back. The judge reacts too. Several of the jurors recoil, seeing a new side of Noah Walker. Everyone's lying. The chief, that detective, the prison snitch, Remy, who couldn't tie his own shoes without help, they're all lying. They set me up. Noah surges to his feet, sweeping his hand, this time knocking the microphone to the floor. They all set me up. They frame me. They're all liars. Sit down, Mr. Walker, or I'll have you restrained, the judge commands. Deputies, he calls out, and quickly 2 sheriff's deputies approach Noah. When Noah doesn't immediately take his seat, one of the deputies grabs his arm. He yanks it free. Both bailiffs reach for their batons, but Noah drops himself back into his chair. The judge calls for order and admonishes Noah. His face has lost all hope now. It's distorted with bitterness. But when he looks up, his expression breaks, the scowl changing to despair, and for the briefest of moments, I think he's looking at me. Then I realize he's looking past me. I glance over my shoulder and see the woman he was with when I arrested him. Paige, I think her name was. She's mouthing something to him from across the courtroom, but I can't make out what she's saying. I look back at Noah, who shakes his head and breaks eye contact. Your Honor, I have no further questions, says Sebastian Akers.
Chapter 29. The first day, Noah didn't think much of it. It had been a long trial. There was a lot of information to review. It could just be the simple matter of plowing through all the material, wanting to be thorough. The second day, he began to wonder. He had no experience with this kind of thing, so he tried not to think too much about it. The third day of jury deliberations, he began to have hope. Somebody on that jury was doing some heavy thinking about his guilt. "Don't read too much into it," his lawyer advised him during a visit. "A lot of people have lost a lot of bets trying to guess what a jury is thinking." At 1:15 on the fourth day of jury deliberations, Noah is summoned by the sheriff's deputy. He is heading, as always, toward the side door of the county courthouse, reserved for prisoner transfers. But the transport vehicle slows a block from the courthouse. The crowd has swelled beyond the sidewalks into the street. There are blockades, but they are hopeless against the swarm of onlookers. The transport vehicle moves slowly, and people grudgingly open a path, shouting at the vehicle as it passes, some of them even slapping the hood or one of the side windows. When the vehicle turns toward the transfer door, Noah sees the trucks from all the national media lined up, faces of reporters he'd seen on television before the trial began, and with whom he's now practically on a first-name basis, plus countless other reporters who couldn't get inside the courtroom but are always here, every morning, ready to shoot video footage or snap his picture. The thousands of locals are here for various reasons: geriatric trial watchers, concerned citizens, people just interested in the spectacle of it all, friends or family of Melanie Phillips. From time to time in the courtroom or standing outside here by the prisoner transfer, he has seen people who vaguely resemble Melanie and wondered if they were cousins or aunts or uncles. Melanie had a big family, though Noah never met any of them. They were only together for 2 months before Melanie ended things. He remembers that day well, the day Melanie broke up with him, her resolve, the firmness of her words.
"I'm sorry, but I've made my decision."
That was it. She wouldn't hear his protests. She just made the statement, a second time to be clear, and that was that. Noah always wondered if she'd discussed it with her friends or family ahead of time. He imagines someone advising her, "It's best to do it clean, just break it off, no long explanations or debate." It bothered him to think that others knew about their breakup before he did. He lets these thoughts occupy him so he won't think about what's coming as he passes down a long corridor lined with armed deputies, as he enters the courtroom from the side and dozens of heads turn in his direction. The law enforcement presence in this room is also heavy. The wall space is occupied by sheriff's deputies ready to keep order when the verdict is read. And then, it's as if everything is underwater, almost dreamlike. His lawyer says something to him, but Noah doesn't really listen. He's gone to another place now, readying himself for what's about to come. Judge Barnett walks in and calls for the jury. The jurors file in and take their seats one by one. You're supposed to watch them as they come in, looking for clues. If they make eye contact, they're going to acquit you. If they don't, they're going to convict. That never made sense to him, why you'd look for clues in the first place, when you're about to find out in a few seconds. Instead, he turns around and finds Paige in the fourth row by the aisle. She moves her head so they can see each other between the other spectators. She mouths the words, "I love you." He wants to stay there, looking at her, but his lawyer takes his arm and he gets to his feet for the reading of the verdict. He turns to face forward but doesn't look at the jury. He finds a blank spot on the wall and stares at it, thinking through everything that has happened and wondering, how did it come to this? He hears a woman's voice. It turns out the foreperson of the jury is a single mother of two who has her own graphic design business, the one who sits in the front row of the jury box, three people from the left end. Is it a good thing that a woman is the leader? Another question that doesn't make any difference. All that matters is what she's going to say next.
On count one, murder in the first degree with special circumstances, to wit the murder of Melanie Phillips, we find the defendant, Noah Lee Walker, guilty.
Noah sucks in his breath.
On count two, murder in the first degree with special circumstances, to wit the murder of Zachary Stern, we find the defendant, Noah Lee Walker, guilty.
Noah turns and sees Paige. He starts toward her and she runs up the aisle toward him.
There are bailiffs covering the gate that cordons off the spectators, and there are other bailiffs assigned specifically to Noah. Both sets of deputies do their jobs. Paige nearly makes it through, coming within a few feet of the defense table. The deputies grasp Noah firmly, gripping his arms, holding down his neck. He goes limp, compliant, before surprising them by breaking free and reaching Paige. It won't last, but he just wants to touch her one more time.
"Oh, baby," she says to him, her face wet.
He puts his hand gently on the back of her neck and kisses her quickly. Then he moves his mouth to her ear.
"Don't give up on me,"
he says, as the deputies recover their leverage, pulling him back. When he refuses to go down, they shove a taser against his neck, electrical current surging through him. His legs and arms go limp just before his mind does. He falls to the floor in a heap, his last memory of this courtroom.
Book 2, Bridgehampton, 2007 to 2008. Chapter 30. Dee Dee Paris and Annie Church have disappeared. They were last seen leaving their last final exam at Yale on May 9th, completing their sophomore years. They said something vague to their friends about backpacking through Europe with the cash they've saved while waitressing. They told their parents they were going to stay in New Haven for summer school and rent an apartment with their waitressing money. Neither set of parents made any attempt to verify their stories. Since May 9th, over 3 weeks ago, no known acquaintance or family member has seen either woman. Which is exactly how they want it. Dee Dee and Annie rush out of the ocean, holding hands, and find their towels and bags and umbrella. They slip into their flip-flops and don their shades. They are two beautiful, tanned 20-year-olds, euphoric with love, with very few answers in life yet, but fortunately, very few questions either. They will have the rest of their lives to discover their calling, to do their internships, apply to grad school, and brace for the hard world. This summer, they're going to discover each other and nothing else. By the time they reach the place where they're staying, their skin has long dried, and the withering oven-hot sun beats down on them. Fortunately, they don't have to go far. Their place is just a 2-minute walk from the beach. They're staying at 7 Ocean Drive. Well, it's not their place exactly, but nobody else is staying here, and it would be a shame for it to stay empty all summer, wouldn't it?
"I love how freak show this house is," Dee Dee says, looking up at the scowling Gothic structure.
She is tall and lanky, with bleached blonde hair cropped like a boy's that practically glows against her suntan.
"I keep waiting for Elvira to pop out or something."
They turn east, walking along the southern border of the estate, covered by thick shrubbery that is taller than they are. Dee Dee, the more athletic and adventurous of the two, was the first to explore the shrubbery, looking for a point of entry. The coiled wire fence hidden within the shrubbery was formidable, but nothing that a good set of shears couldn't handle, if you had time and patience, and they had plenty of both this summer. Besides, it didn't have to be pretty. Just a large enough hole for them to slip through, the slipping made easier by the thick pieces of rubber they've tied over the jagged edges of fence to avoid cuts and scratches during ingress and egress. Sure, they have to squat down and turn sideways to make it through, but it's worth it. Rent-free, and a 10,000-square-foot mansion all to themselves. As they slide through the opening, Annie looks up at the mansion, the faded multicolored limestone, the stained glass and sharply pitched roofs and medieval-style adornments. She remembers the week she spent in the Hamptons as a girl when she and her sister heard all about this place.
"No one ever leaves alive the house at 7 Ocean Drive," she says in her best ghoulish horror movie voice, repeating the poem she'd heard. "Not friend or foe, not man or mouse, can e'er survive the murder house."
"That creeps me out," Dee Dee says.
They head toward the rear of the house. The 10-foot shrubbery provides good cover on the grounds, but the mansion itself is perched on a hill, and they've decided their entries and exits should be as covert as possible. In the rear, there is a door that, once upon a time, was probably reserved for the servants. The door doesn't have a knob, just a latch held closed by a chain, another victim of Dee Dee's shears. The smell of disinfectant and soap greets them when they open the door. They scrub down the rear entrance the first time they came in, clearing out the cobwebs, mopping the floor, scrubbing the walls. The first thing they see is the door to the basement, which is likewise chained. Sure, they thought it was a little odd that an interior door would be locked in such a way, but they haven't bothered to investigate. There's enough house without it, and their tolerance for creepy has just about hit its limit. The basement will remain a mystery. They pass through the foyer, ignoring the museum-like rooms on each side, and climb the winding, creaky stairs. A veranda off a bedroom on the third floor that they found last week has a panoramic view of the ocean. Annie leans against the railing, sighing with satisfaction. Her hair, up in a ponytail, is the color of cinnamon, but has lightened in the sun. Dee Dee comes up behind her and kisses her long bronzed neck. She runs her hands along the outline of Annie's figure. Annie leans back into Dee Dee's arms, gently humming as Dee Dee cups her breasts, caresses the skin on her flat belly.
"That tickles," says Annie as she turns to face Dee Dee.
They kiss deeply and lie down together on the blanket they've spread out, their legs intertwined. And then they hear a noise, the hollow clink of metal tapping metal, and footsteps, and then a man whistling. Staying low, they inch toward the side of the veranda and peek through the wooden supports. A man approaches the side of the house with a long ladder held at his side. He is shirtless and looks pretty damn good that way. A V-shaped physique, rippled abs. His curly dark hair falls from a Yankees cap turned backward.
"Hot tool belt guy," Annie whispers. "If I liked boys..."
The hot tool belt guy drops the ladder against the side of the house and quickly climbs up. The women don't move, holding their breath, as he reaches their level on the third floor.
"Just behave yourselves, ladies," he says without looking in their direction. "Deal?"
Busted. Neither woman says anything. Neither woman moves.
"Deal?"
he repeats. Dee Dee stands up, leans on the railing.
"We have to behave? That's no fun."
Annie stands up too.
"So what's your story, guy?"
The man gestures upward with his chin.
"Me? I'm just patching up the flat roof. Not having as much fun as you, looks like."
"That's not fair,"
Annie says, which sounds close to an invitation. She gets an elbow from Dee Dee.
"So what's your name?"
"Noah," he says.
"Are you going to turn us in, Noah?"
Dee Dee asks. He considers them a moment.
"Well, that wouldn't be very nice, would it?"
"It sure wouldn't."
"Just don't make a mess while you're here," he says. "I'll have to clean it up."
He starts to climb. Both girls can't help but enjoy the view. Straight or gay, this guy is hard not to admire.
"And one more thing," he says as he reaches the flat roof. "Don't go in the basement."
"Why's that, Noah?"
"Didn't you hear? This house is haunted."
The man hauls himself up on the roof and disappears. Chapter 31. Annie's beater VW bug pulls up to the gate of Seven Ocean Drive. The sun has fallen now at 9 o'clock, so all is clear. When they use their car, which isn't very often, they prefer to enter and exit under the cover of darkness. Dee Dee gets out to push open the massive gate, using all her weight to do so. Once it's open, she turns back, squinting into the car's headlights. Beyond the beams, across the street, she sees someone standing flat-footed, looking at her. She does a double-take, shields her eyes with a hand, which doesn't really help, and moves away from the blinding beams to get a better look. It seems as if the figure moves along with her and then disappears, maybe into the shrubbery, leaving Dee Dee with spots in her vision from the car lights. Dee Dee rushes back to the car and gets in.
"What's the matter?"
Annie asks.
"I thought I saw someone across the street staring at us, watching us."
Annie strains to look behind her.
"I didn't see anyone when we drove up." "I know, me either. What did he look like?"
Dee Dee lets out a shudder,
couldn't really see. A man, looked like. Kind of, you're gonna laugh. Like a scarecrow, sort of. Like his hair was all stringy and sticking out. He had a hat on, too, I think. A scarecrow?
Annie looks at Dee Dee with mock horror.
You don't think. The Tin Man might be out there, too.
Stop.
Not the Cowardly Lion.
Annie brings a hand to her mouth.
Just drive the car.
Annie pats Dee Dee's leg.
You're paranoid, girl. We're not supposed to be here, so you think everyone's looking to bust us. I mean, someone walking down Ocean Drive in the summer isn't exactly unusual.
She puts the car into gear and drives through the gate. Dee Dee closes the gate behind them, taking another look across the street, and seeing nothing.
That's the thing, though, she says when she re-enters the car. He wasn't walking. He was just watching us. I mean, I think. With the headlights, I couldn't really see. It could just be my eyes playing tricks.
Annie pulls the Beetle onto the grass next to the massive detached garage, hidden from sight. She lets out a sigh.
Good to be home, she says. There's no place like home. There's no place like... Would you shut up?
As they walk toward the back entrance, they see the ladder the hot tool belt guy used yesterday, broken down and lying in the grass.
Noah was cute,
Annie says.
Was he? Was he cute?
Dee Dee throws another elbow.
Now, dearest, I only have eyes for you.
Inside, they unpack their groceries. They found a place in Montauk that sells lobster tails and oysters at non-tourist prices, and Dee Dee apparently looks old enough to buy champagne. The cheapest they had. Tonight is an anniversary of sorts, exactly 6 months from the day they met on campus. Annie gets the food ready while whistling that Wizard of Oz song, If I Only Had a Brain. Dee Dee keeps punching her playfully in the arm, but it only emboldens Annie. As much as it gets under her skin, it's one of the reasons Dee Dee loves her.
Yes, she thinks, I do love her.
Dee Dee has no trouble opening her heart to Annie. She's accepted her sexual orientation for years now. She came out in high school, and she grew up in Santa Monica, where they practically throw you a parade for doing so. Annie, though, had never been with a woman before meeting Dee Dee. Of course, she knew on some level, but growing up in rural Michigan, she didn't acknowledge her sexual preference to her friends or her devout Catholic parents, or even to herself. You'd think, by 2007, people would have loosened up enough, but Dee Dee knows as well as anyone that discrimination doesn't evaporate overnight, but slowly fades over time. Dinner is great. The dining room is over the top ornate, full of all kinds of detail on the walls, little statuettes perched around the room, tall windows with ornamental trim, an enormous chandelier hovering over a big five-sided dark oak table that's surrounded by high-backed chairs with leather cushions. It's like Henry VIII meets Count Dracula. On their jambox, they play some symphonic music that Annie, the violinist, chose. She plays maestro, conducting the music with her fork. And the lobster and oysters are delicious. The cheap champagne is like pop rocks in Dee Dee's mouth. It goes to her head quickly, enhancing her euphoria.
Annie is it, she thinks. She is my one and only.
The window rattles and Dee Dee turns to it. The wind, surely, but still, she walks over and cups her hand over the glass to block the interior reflection, looking out onto Ocean Drive.
Is the scarecrow still out there? I'd be more worried about him if he only had a brain. You've been waiting to say that, haven't you?
Dee Dee looks back and finds Annie sitting on the windowsill on the opposite side of the dining room.
What are you doing?
Annie has her Swiss Army knife open, carving into the wood.
Annie, you can't do that. This place is like 300 years old. And it's not like you can just erase that.
Dee Dee walks over to get a look at what Annie is doing. As Dee Dee suspected, she is carving their initials in jagged letters. DP plus AC.
I don't want to erase it, Annie says. I want it to be here forever.
Dee Dee puts her arm around Annie and draws her close, breathing in her shampoo.
Forever?
She says tentatively. Her heart is pounding. This is one of those moments when she feels so vulnerable,
her heart laid bare to be embraced or trampled. Forever. Annie looks up at Dee Dee. The champagne tastes even better to Dee Dee the second time, on Annie's tongue.
Chapter 32. The girls staying at Seven Ocean Drive are now on the second floor of the mansion, the southwest bedroom. The purple and gold bedroom, with the canopy bed and the velvet. The master bedroom where, over 200 years ago, Winston Dahlquist once slept. They are naked, and they are doing very fun things to each other. Their young bodies are shapely and athletic and limber, fueled by lust and maybe love, who can say, and helped mightily by the two bottles of champagne they've drunk. The alcohol has undoubtedly lowered their inhibitions and also impaired their judgment a bit, which is probably why they've forgotten to pull the bedroom drapes. Now, to be fair, the bedroom window looks south toward the beach at Ocean, with only one house in between, which is not nearly as tall. A reasonable person would thus believe that even with the drapes open wide as they are, she would not be visible to anyone. But a reasonable person might not expect a man to be standing on the beach, peering northward with a pair of binoculars. The man who thinks of himself as Holden lowers the binoculars and lets them hang around his neck. Wait, no. No, no. He removes the binoculars and throws them into his bag, which he calls his fun bag. This time of night, having binoculars is a dead giveaway. No chance of bird watching or any other legitimate reason for using them at 10 in the evening. You might just as well wear a sign that says, Peeping Tom. Be more careful, Holden. He likes calling himself that name. It gets him in the mood. In much the same way the alcohol gets those girls feeling more sexually adventurous. He rolls his neck, stretches his arms, cracks his knuckles, jogs in place a moment, some sand kicking up. He picks up his fun bag and climbs the beach onto Ocean Drive. He is happy, almost giddy. The sky is a deep purple and a soft wind plays with his hair. He is healthy and prepared. Tonight, he is Holden. And he can do anything. He wonders how long they'll stay up in the bedroom. Could be they'll fall asleep, exhausted from the alcohol and sex. It won't matter. He'll be prepared either way. They probably have the doors locked. They certainly should. There are scary people out there. Not that a lock will stop him. He has a key to the place, after all. But the front door isn't an option. Too creaky and noisy. No, he'll use his private entry, his secret way into the house, reserved for special occasions. Because this has all the makings of a special occasion. Chapter 33. Holden rests in the room that Winston Dahlquist once called the guest parlor, a waiting room of sorts off the ground floor living room. It is ridiculously ornate, like all the rooms. Candelabra and chandeliers and custom molding, a fireplace and a marble mantel, a Persian area rug. They are almost directly above him. He closes his eyes and listens to their laughter upstairs. They are in love, he thinks, or at least they sound like it. His heart is pounding. He is here, and they don't know it. That is special all by itself. They think they're sharing something intimate, but he gets to be a part of it. He opens up a small compact and checks himself over. His hair is smartly combed. His shirt is pressed. His beige trousers are new. His erection is at full mast, pushing against his trousers. There's no way to describe this. One part forbidden, one part intimate, one part sexual, and one part full of possibilities unknown even to him. He's not sure what he's going to do yet. There should be a word for how he feels. He thinks of how they'd react if they saw him. What would they say? What would they do? The snappy dialogue that would ensue. The flirtation. They'd be attracted to him, wouldn't they? Of course they would. Maybe a threesome. Wow. Maybe. Footsteps overhead,
Holden shakes out of his fantasy and listens closely. The footsteps are heading...
where?
Down the hallway, toward the staircase? No. No, she's just walking into the master bedroom. He hears the water turn on now. He sighs. This is not good enough. Not real enough. He thought this was going to be special. This is kind of fun, but not special. He's too far away from them, too remote. Should he go up the stairs? No, that would be too risky. The kitchen, maybe. There will be glasses and dishes they touched. Maybe an article of clothing they left behind. That would help. That would really help. He has to take a piss, but he can't do that. Even if he used the bathroom near the back, and even if he sat down like a girl to cut down on the noise, he'd either have to flush, which they'd hear, or leave evidence behind. He's not stupid. He's not stupid at all. Stupid? He's the opposite of stupid. He's really smart. Oh, maybe he should just leave. But tonight I'm Holden. Okay. He removes his shoes to minimize his footfalls and drops them in the fun bag. He picks it up and pushes it through the French doors quietly into the living room. From there, he walks through the foyer. He stops at the staircase where he hears them upstairs singing in unison to Justin Timberlake. I'll let you whip me if I misbehave. It's just that no one makes me feel this way. He smiles to himself, feels himself relax. Feeling better, he walks into the dining room, where two empty bottles of champagne, an empty bottle of Evian, a bottle of Tabasco, two plates of discarded lobster tails and oyster shells, and a dish of horseradish rest on the pentagonal table beneath the grand chandelier. Winston Dahlquist used to bring the girls in here. They'd feast on duck and lobster and dates and olives. They'd drink the finest French wines. He probably viewed it as fattening them up before the slaughter. He hikes the fun bag over his shoulder, carefully picks up one of the empty champagne bottles and one of the plates, and heads into the kitchen. He's never liked the kitchen much because it's not original. Back when Winston built this place, the kitchen was for servants only, tiny and functional. Winston's descendants remodeled the kitchen in the 70s, tripling the size, installing cherry wood cabinets, marble countertops, and stainless steel appliances. It just looks like a boring kitchen, no character. But it's safe, and it will have to do. He opens up the fun bag just to be safe, just to be sure, just to be prepared. He thinks of the girls having sex upstairs, and then singing sexy back, and it helps him. They'd like him, he's sure of it. They could share so much. He smells the champagne bottle, nothing special. Then he sees lipstick on it, so he touches it with his lips. Not cherry chapstick, but red and sticky and sweet. Yes, good. This is getting better now. This was a good idea. And then it happens in an instant, sneaking up on him. How it could have happened, he isn't sure, because he's so cautious and careful, but he hears footsteps bounding down the stairs, and suddenly those footsteps are in the dining room, adjacent to the kitchen where he is. He moves very quietly toward the opening, hoping, praying that nobody heard him, and peeks into the dining room. It's the blonde, the taller one with the short hair. She's unplugging the stereo resting on the windowsill. She looks good bending over, just wearing a bra and panties. So firm and lean. So special. Oh, God, if I could just... He ducks back, just on the off chance that she might cast a glance in his direction. His heartbeat is drumming so loudly that he can't hear. He can't think straight, but he prepares just in case. He's had it planned out just in case, and he recites it to himself now. I'm the owner. This is my house. Just in case. And he reaches into the fun bag, also just in case. He slowly steps back into the recesses of the kitchen and holds his breath. It'll be okay, he thinks. This will be better. It will enhance the whole experience, make it more real, more vivid.
That's what he's telling himself when the blonde girl walks into the kitchen. Chapter 34. The blonde girl doesn't see him at first. Her head is down, and she's balancing the remnants of the meal, the champagne and water bottles, the plates of food, and the Tabasco, and turns toward the counter in the center of the kitchen to plop it all down before she even realizes she's not alone. She recoils in an instant, her breath whisked away in surprise, her hands rising up defensively, everything she'd been holding crashing to the tile floor. Glass shatters everywhere. The sound only amplifies her shock. Be indignant. This is your house. She's the intruder. Say that. Say that. I'm the owner, he manages. He raises a hand in peace. The girl is too stunned for a moment, but Holden planned this out well. The words did the trick. She doesn't turn and run, not immediately.
You're the own? Dee Dee, is everything okay?
It's the other girl.
Dee Dee?
The blonde looks back toward the living room, then back at Holden.
How many of you are here?
He asks.
Excellent. Just what an indignant owner would say. Just two of... Oh.
Her eyes dart downward just as Holden feels the warm stain spreading across his crotch. He just pissed himself. He looks down and then back up at her.
We'll leave right now, mister. I'm really sorry.
She spins on her heels to leave. Holden closes the distance between them in an instant. She senses his approach and starts to run and is nearly out the door when he reaches her, stabbing the taser into the back of her neck. She goes down hard, her body suddenly limp and unable to break her fall, her face smacking against the kitchen wall and landing hard on the ceramic tile.
Dee Dee?
Comes the voice from upstairs. Holden drags the blonde girl, Dee Dee, into the kitchen, away from the view of the dining room, a trail of blood smearing in her wake. Is she dead? The fall was nasty. She's bleeding from the nose and forehead. What has he done? What's he going to do? He's thinking fast, but the adrenaline is catching up with him now, and he can't let it paralyze him. He's got to think. Hearing the urgent footfalls in the living room, Holden grabs a frying pan from the overhead rack and raises it above his head. The brunette gasps before she's even entered, seeing the bloodstain first, no doubt. And when she rushes in, her eyes are already cast downward at her lover. She lets out a horrific scream as she looks up to meet Holden's eyes, but by then, the frying pan is already crashing down on the crown of her skull. The pan almost bounces out of Holden's hand from the harsh impact. He's never hit anything so hard. The brunette is stunned, reaching for support, but unable to find any. She sinks to her knees, still upright but precariously so, and before she falls like a tower tumbling over, Holden raises the pan and cracks it against her skull a second time. When she crumples to the floor, she is lifeless, like a balloon figurine that the air has been let out of. Her eyes are open but still. Is she dead? Holden bounces on his toes, looking at each of them. The blonde is still breathing. The brunette is not.
It was a accident, he says. I just wanted...
What does he do now? Panic sweeps over him. Run, he thinks. But
no, too many clues left behind.
The blonde knows what he looks like. She moans, her shoulders move. She's trying to turn over. Holden watches her struggle, watches her suffer. But this is their fault. They shouldn't have surprised him. They made him do this.
No.
The blonde is making noise on the floor. He taps her with his foot. She groans in response. He bends down and rolls her over on her back, turns her bloodied face to the left so she can see her girlfriend.
Look at her, he says. Look.
Her eyes widen in horror. She manages a low, guttural, garbled wail. It's the most beautiful sound he's ever heard. Chapter 35. Holden puts a hand on his stomach. It causes a physical pain, a rumble in his stomach like hunger for food, a growl that resembles the angry hum of the motorcycle on which he's riding at the moment. He needs it again.
He needs the thrill of the chase, the anticipation, the climax itself. It's been over a year since Dee Dee and Annie, and he can't decide what was most invigorating. The initial approach, sneaking into the mansion, the physical act, the pain and suffering. So much to choose from. It's kind of like deciding what you like best about pizza, the cheese or the sauce or the toppings. They are inseparable ingredients of a delicious experience. But if he had to choose, it was none of those things. No. It was the aftermath. What's happened every day since. The feeling of invincibility that comes with knowing he got away with it. That he can do whatever he pleases and nobody can catch him. Nobody can stop him. Oh, there was an investigation. Apparently the girls, Dee Dee Paris and Annie Church, hadn't told anyone where they were spending the summer. They had told their friends one lie, their parents another, but nobody the truth. It was only through cell phone records that authorities were able to place them in the Hamptons at all. But it was over 2 weeks after he'd killed them that a search even began, and it wasn't much of a search. Nobody had any idea where the girls were staying in the Hamptons. They never even focused on Bridgehampton, much less the house at 7 Ocean Drive. The best guess was that the girls were staying in Montauk, because that was where they found Annie's car, in a tow yard after it had been parked illegally in a church parking lot, stripped of its license plates. Yes, Holden has congratulated himself for moving her car. It was when the authorities found the car that they officially determined, drumroll please, that foul play was involved. Ta-da! They don't have a clue. The lesson? You can do whatever you want, if you're smart, if you're disciplined, if you take care in choosing your victims, if you don't get greedy. He drives by the nightclub again, passing the alley where they congregate in the shadows, waiting for any car that might pull over. He slows his motorcycle to an idle and looks to his right, directly where he knows they are. Several of them step out from the shadows into the light of the street lamp, in their skin-tight dresses hiked up to show plenty of leg, their hair teased up, their boobs pushed out, hoping to make eye contact with potential customers. There are a half dozen of them, a nice variety of busty and petite, white and black and Hispanic, a smorgasbord of potential victims. Victims. It's fun to think of them that way. Not women, but prey. He immediately crosses the tall, leggy blonde off the list, because she is too much like Dee Dee, though Dee Dee ended up being great fun in the end. Still, variety is the spice of life, and, more to the point, an intelligent man like Holden realizes that he cannot leave a pattern of any kind in his wake. He quickly narrows it down to a busty black woman and a petite blonde. The blonde one it is, smaller probably no more than 100 pounds, and therefore easier to subdue should any difficulty arise. But why should any difficulty arise? He has his fun bag back at the motel. And unlike last time, when Dee Dee and Annie surprised him, this time he'll have the chance to show off his charm, to gain her trust, lure her in. She'll have no idea what's coming. She'll probably think the corkscrew is for a bottle of champagne. She'll think the handcuffs are just a kinky sex thing. She might wonder about the handheld kitchen torch, though. It's past midnight, and there is a healthy stream of people coming and going from the club nearby. Witnesses, potentially. A careful man like Holden thinks of such things. But most are drunk, and in the end, what could they say about him? He's wearing a helmet with a tinted face shield, and he's removed the license plate. All anyone could possibly describe is a guy in a leather jacket wearing a helmet on a black motorcycle. Anyway, if it was entirely risk-free, it wouldn't be any fun. Yet he feels a pang of doubt, even as he nods toward the petite blonde. Can he go through with it? He's rusty. It's been over a year. As much as he's been romanticizing it since then, he now remembers how scared he was at the time. Exhilarated, yes, but scared, too. On his nod, the blonde saunters up to him,
wearing a black outfit that covers little more than a bikini would. Her belly is flat, with a piercing through her navel. She has the body of a 20-year-old, the face of someone older, more seasoned, more worked over. Her heels make her 2 inches taller, but she's a little thing.
Hi, handsome. You want some company?
I want all night, he says, keeping his helmet on, the face shield down.
I'm by the hour, hon.
I want all night. That's Holden being smart. If she's leaving for the night, nobody will expect her back in an hour. Nobody will think to look for her, at least until tomorrow. Assuming anybody looks for her, period.
The whole night? That's 2,000.
She runs her hand over his arm, the leather of his jacket.
It's worth it.
No, he says. See, that's Holden being smart again. Make her think this is a real negotiation, that he actually plans on paying her something. 500.
500 for this?
She says, running her hands over the outline of her body, moving to the music coming from the nightclub.
Come on, lover. 1,500. For a night you'll never forget.
He doesn't know what a streetwalker makes in a night, but it can't be anywhere near that.
1,000, he says. Oh, baby, hang on.
The girl walks back to her friends and says something.
See, you were right. She's telling them she's done for the night, not to expect her back. Smart, Holden.
Do I need a helmet?
She asks when she hops on the bike. He turns back to her as she wraps her arms around his waist.
No, he says. You're safe with me.
Chapter 36. Holden and the blonde hooker drive to a motel off Sunrise Highway. He rented the room 2 days ago, paying in cash and asking for a room in the back, away from traffic. He parks within 10 feet of the door and brings the girl inside. The room isn't much to look at. The carpet is torn up, the wallpaper is peeling, the lighting is dim, and the mattress is about as thick as a slice of cheese. But it's clean, and it doesn't smell. He's seen worse, and he's certain she has too. He sets his helmet on the small table where the television sits. He spots the fun bag in the corner, just where he left it. He looks in the mirror and fixes his hair.
We need to take care of business first.
He turns and gets his first look at her in normal lighting. She has a round face, her eyes set slightly too far apart, with a crooked smile that is probably supposed to be sexy. Her dirty blonde hair is teased up in some kind of bun on top of her head. She is very slender, and her skin is pale and freckly. Her breasts are small, and her butt is tiny and round.
Okay.
He has 1,000 in cash. He peels it out and hands it to her. She stuffs it in her purse. Is that her idea of safekeeping? It must be. Though it's not that safe. She's in a room with a stranger, after all. It's not safe at all. She's not safe at all. But that's an occupational hazard. Everything she does is full of risk. That must be hard, having to make a living by meeting strange men and...
Stop it. Stop thinking like that.
I'm gonna freshen up, she says, and then she spins on her heels and heads to the bathroom, her red purse slung over her shoulder.
He looks at himself in the mirror.
Don't start thinking about her life. Think about what you want. Think about what you're going to do. Think about the handcuffs and the corkscrew and the torch. Don't fuck this up. You've been waiting a year for this.
She returns looking a little more chipper, her eyes glassy. She's high. She took something in the bathroom. He looks over her arms. No signs of needle marks. Cocaine, probably. That's probably how she gets through this job, high as a kite.
Stop it. You don't give a shit about her or how she copes with life. You don't care.
So what's your pleasure, guy?
Her tone is less flirtatious than it was on the street, more businesslike.
What do you want me to do?
Her eyes bug out, like she's impatient.
Can we just talk?
He's trembling. She looks at his hands. She sees it too.
Okay, we can talk.
She sits down on the bed and looks up at him. What do you want to talk about?
He swallows hard. What the hell is wrong with you? What's your name?
She shrugs.
What do you want it to be?
He shakes his head.
No. Okay, my name's Barbie.
Her name isn't Barbie. That's her street name.
Do you want to know my name? Sure, mister. Lots of guys don't want to tell me their name. It's your money.
He stares at her, unsure of himself.
Okay, what's your name, guy?
She's so hardened, deadened, drugged out. She'll spread her legs for him or suck him off. She'll twist and turn her body however he asks, but she won't really be here. This isn't real. It's not supposed to be like this. Dee Dee and Annie, they were real. He thought the one thing missing was that he didn't know them first, didn't get intimate with them, killed them almost at first sight. But that was better. That was better than this.
Got anything to drink, mister?
He shakes his head, unable to speak. He should have thought of that. He should have had a bottle of whiskey or something.
Got any music?
Shit. He shakes his head again. He feels everything slipping away, every turn a wrong one.
I can't,
he whispers.
Can't what?
Sweat has broken out on his forehead. His pulse is racing. He doesn't feel right.
I can't kill you,
he says. His eyes slowly rise to meet hers. She studies him a moment, lips parted, fear beginning to spread across her face. He feels himself getting hard. He feels the energy suddenly fueling him. And then her eyes grow big again when she sees the look on his face.
There. There it is.
She bounces off the bed, rushing for the door.
Yes. No, she cries as he grabs her arm. No, please.
He pins her up against the wall, bringing a hand over her mouth. She bites down on his hand, causing a glorious pain, but he pushes back hard, slamming her head against the wall with all the force he can summon. Her eyes roll back, and she begins to slide down the wall, unconscious. He lowers himself, sliding down with her. He drags her over near the bed and lays her out properly.
Thank you, Barbie, he whispers.
He handled this wrong, but she salvaged it for him, a last-minute save. He learned something. He won't make this mistake again. He walks to the corner to get his fun bag.
Book 3, Bridgehampton and Sing Sing, 2012. Chapter 37. Sing Sing Correctional Facility, 30 miles north of New York City on the east bank of the Hudson River, houses nearly 2,000 inmates over 55 acres of property. Up the hill from the lower level secured facilities is Cell Block A, Maximum A, one of the largest max security cell blocks in the world, with over 600 inmates packed into 6 by 9 foot cells. There are murderers and rapists and sex traffickers and mob bosses and major drug dealers divided into fierce factions, predominantly by race. The Bloods and the Crips, the Latin Kings and the Trinitarios, the Aryan Brotherhood. If you belong to one of the gangs, they have your back, you're protected. But even then, you're not really protected, because the sins of the individual are the sins of the gang, and retaliation in Cell Block A is as common as census counts 4 times a day. In the last 8 days, Cell Block A has been on lockdown 4 times, as the Latin Kings and the Bloods have worked out their differences the only way they know how. Guns are uncommon. It's by shanks and razors, anything that can be pried loose and sharpened into a weapon, that most of the injuries are inflicted. The first time Noah Walker walked into Cell Block A, he was overwhelmed. Overwhelmed by the sheer enormity, the cell block extending 4 stories high and so far from right to left that there seems to be no beginning or end, just an endless wall of steel and chain-link barriers. Overwhelmed by the noise, a deafening clamor of hundreds of caged men shouting, radios playing, gates slamming. This is his home now, on the top tier of A Block, Gallery L, 7th cell. He will live in L7 for the rest of his life. He will live amid a massive series of cages, covered by a concrete and brick dome with windows that miraculously let in very little light, sunshine filtered through filth. The polluted air, the noise, the solitude of hour upon hour spent in a cell no bigger than a normal person's closet. In the 73 days that Noah has spent here, they have had the effect of deadening him, killing his hope, erasing his dreams, leaving him numb. Outside the cell, the mess hall, the showers, the machine shop, and the prison yard, it's a different story. Noah is alert at all times, his eyes constantly moving about. Noah is not affiliated. The only real option for a white guy is the Aryan Brotherhood, and he's not going anywhere near those racist morons. That makes him fair game to everyone. Stick a shank into Noah's back, or accost him in the shower, or jump him in the yard, and nobody will retaliate. Noah is alone in every sense of the word. And with every day that passes, he finds that he cares less and less. There is nothing for him here but the passage of time. He is simply waiting for time to move along until he dies. His tiny cell is barren of personal effects. He hasn't built up enough in the commissary for a radio, and no television is allowed. He has only two